I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today our guest is Jeff Zausch, a survivalist that you'll know from the Naked and Afraid TV series. Hey Peter, this is going to be a lot of fun.
Have you watched the show?
I've watched the show many times, and there's a few things I got to ask some questions about.
Oh, totally.
Maybe this will give us survival skills to try out. But first, I think we need to get into some nature news, and you got something pretty cool hot off the press.
We got some fun stuff, and this is actually relatively recent. The Global Wildlife Conservation Organization, so not-for-profit, and partners have rediscovered a species that was lost since 1990. So we're looking at 20-plus years, and it's the silver-backed chevrotain.
The chevrotain.
Chevrotain. For our listeners, this is the South Asia, Vietnam version of Africa's dik-dik.
Boy, I think you just painted the picture for
Everyone knows what I'm talking about now.
What does this animal look like?
It's commonly called the mouse deer. It's not a mouse, nor is it a deer. It is the smallest of small ungulates.
Okay.
It's a hoofed animal. Okay. Less than 5 kgs, so it's less than 10 pounds. And it's found in the Greater Annamite Mountains of southern Vietnam. And this is just basically a tropical forest region. And they've had multiple new species discoveries in this area because it's really hard to traverse. They actually thought, not sighting it for 20-odd years, they thought it was extinct. Well, they had some local people say, hey, we've noticed we're describing this silverback chevrotain. And thank goodness for camera traps. Because in 10 months, they were able to record over 2,000 photos of this little ungulate.
So it's around there hopping around?
It's around there hopping. But can you imagine in the mountainous region of these massive forests and you're under 10 pounds?
So this is an animal, it has fangs?
Yes. There are deer that do have fangs or canines. You know, our own elk, Rocky Mountain elk, they have these molars up on their upper plate that is kind of a residual type fang. There's the Siberian musk deer that also has fangs.
Okay.
And why? I'm not quite sure.
It's great to know that they're still around.
Yes.
And now we can see them.
Yes.
Because we've got these little cameras that can...
That can catch these things. Right, right. So this, I mean, it's a plus. When you think about what's happening across the world, we've got this, it's called the bushmeat crisis.
Sure.
And we like to have these words that kind of pull at your heartstrings. And one is the empty forest syndrome. And that's where all these animals are basically disappearing from a forest. And as you walk through the forest, it's quiet when it shouldn't be quiet. And it's a major ecological problem. And they think that these chevrotains were a victim of the bushmeat crisis. Leg snares are indiscriminate killers, and this is what they were really feeling was happening with these guys. It's a good story. We got them. Yeah.
We got them. That's good. That's fantastic news. Well, before we get going too far, it's trivia time. And today's question, well, it deals with maybe some dangerous elements that you could find in Idaho. The question is, what are the two venomous snakes in Idaho? Well, we'll answer that question and talk a whole lot more right after this break.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org, or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Well, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome Jeff Zausch. He's here with us in the studio today. It's great to see him again. He used to work at the Idaho Museum of Natural History. He's here in Pocatello, and you guys all know him from the Naked and Afraid TV series you can see on Discovery. And so welcome to the show.
Thank you guys so much. I'm happy to be here, and thank you for letting me wear clothes.
It's a
rather big blessing, so I appreciate that.
And we appreciate it as well.
we're all dressed for radio.
Right, totally appropriately dressed for radio. So, you know, Jeff, the obvious question really is, why did you decide to go on Naked and Afraid, and how did you get interested in kind of these survival type programs?
Well, I mean, it's a great question. Like everybody, I watch the show Naked and Afraid on TV. You know, after a long day at work, you know, it's a little, you know, a casual thing to turn on. And secretly, I always thought I could do better, you know, than the people I was watching. But I never voiced it or anything. And then out of the blue on a random Tuesday, I get a phone call. And it's somebody from a casting agency asking me if I'd be interested in possibly doing Naked and Afraid. And my first response was no. You know, I'm not going to be naked on television. I'm fairly conservative. I come from a conservative family. The naked thing did not appeal to me. But once it became, you know, real that these people actually want me to do this program, I couldn't say no because, like I said, I thought I could do better than anybody else that had done it before. So I thought, well, why not? We live once, right?
Sure thing. So yeah. Had you applied or how did they get in contact with you, I guess?
I hadn't applied. They found me on Instagram. Okay. I was a well-known mountain climber for several years. I grew up in my young 20s. I had summited a lot of the highest peaks here in the Northwest United States. And I guess they were just searching for outdoor-minded folks on Instagram and stumbled upon me.
Yeah, well, let's turn the clock back a little bit. Tell us about your upbringing and you tipped your hat to this idea that you were climbing, you know, our top peaks. So what got you into that in the first place?
I grew up here in Pocatello, born and raised here, graduated from Century High School and Idaho State. And I grew up on a small farm outside of Pocatello in Bannock County. I was raised by some real true mountain men that, you know, taught me how to hunt and fish and trap from a young age. And I fell in love with it. But when I got into my young teens, I kind of wanted to take things to the next level beyond what I had been taught. So I started to push the limits and really learn from experience and, you know, stay out longer periods of time with less food and less resources, climb higher peaks in more harsh conditions and so forth. So, through my life, I've just always enjoyed pushing the limits of what I'm capable.
So did Naked and Afraid push your limits?
It did. It did on several different occasions.
Excellent.
Absolutely.
Now, do you have higher limits after Naked and Afraid?
Absolutely. Naked and Afraid tested me, but I still have not found that wall. I've been able to accomplish every single challenge that they've presented to me, and I believe I've done so in a very positive light. So, the sky's the limit.
You did two shows, correct?
Three.
Three shows. All right. Of the three shows, what was the most challenging moment you experienced in those three shows?
That's a difficult question because I have a lot of them. I did survive 21 days Naked and Afraid in Madagascar. I survived 40 days Naked and Afraid in Colombia. And most recently, I survived 60 days Naked and Afraid in the jungles of the Philippines. But the most difficult moment for me has to be day 52 of 60 in the Philippines. I contracted bacterial meningitis while I was out there. I didn't know what I had, but I had 105 degree fever.
Wow.
And I was at risk of having to tap out of the challenge and go to the hospital. And so at 11 p.m. at night, I went and sat in the river, ice cold river, and up to my neck with 105 degree fever, just looking up at the stars, shivering my brains out, trying not to chew my tongue off. The most intense agony I've ever experienced in my entire life. I sat in that river for hours, but it broke my fever. And I was able to push through the final 8 days of the challenge.
I got to tell you, that is so inspiring. I might have to try Naked and Afraid.
You might just.
Well, tell us a little bit about, you've done three of these expeditions. Take us behind the scenes, I guess. What's it kind of like when you're starting one of these adventures? What's the support structure around you?
No, great question. Because there's a lot you don't get to see on television.
Sure.
One of the most difficult moments is day one, when they take you out to the location via helicopter, boat, 4x4, whatever it is, and they drop you off. And 2 minutes later, they say, okay, take your clothes off now.
So,
you know, it's very, very awkward.
How soon do you know the location?
About 7 days prior
okay.
to the flight. And so there's not enough time to really do any research. I rely off of my experience more than anything. Mm-hmm. I do not want to put my life on the line with information obtained by Google or Wikipedia. And so I choose to just go with my experience and figure it out while I'm there. But while we're there, we do have a camera crew following us around, typically one sound guy, a producer, and one or two camera guys. And they never talk to us. They keep their distance. They film with long lens cameras. And so they try to interact as very frequently as possible. They don't want to interfere with our hunting. They don't want to interfere with our mindset and what's going on with us mentally. But even though they do that, it's difficult for me because I'm a hunter. I pride myself on my hunting skills. And when you have four other men following behind sure. you, wearing boots, making noise, putting down scent, it makes hunting exponentially more difficult.
Yeah, at a certain point, do you forget that they're there? Does it ever get to that point where you're really in the zone, locked in, and they become sort of wallpaper?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'd say that happens by day three.
Okay.
By day three, you're starting to get hungry. You're starting to get thirsty. You may or may not have started a friction fire by then. You're still working on putting your shelter together before the next storm hits. And so you have all this going on. You don't care about the film crew by that time. You
sure.
you don't even care that they're there.
With water, it's not like you're getting a pot to boil the water. So once you get your fire going, how do you, in a sense, purify the water? Or are you worried that there might be parasites or other nasties in that water that you have to drink?
Such a good question. So I've survived 121 days naked and afraid so far. And I can honestly say one of the most difficult things is finding a natural bowl in the environment to boil water in. It's incredibly difficult. And in the Philippines, it was easy because we had a large, thick bamboo.
Okay.
So we were able to cut some bamboo and boil it in that. But for example, in Madagascar, I was in the desert. We had nothing except stone. And so every 3 days I was out grinding myself a stone bowl to boil water in. And of course it heats up and it cracks within 2 or 3 days and you have to make another one. And it is so difficult. I find it's easier to create some type of water filtration device than it is to create a bowl to boil in.
So go through your homemade water filtration device.
Typically I use bamboo if I have it as a cylinder. Or if I don't, I just find enough vegetation to make some type of cylinder about 2 feet high. And I layer that with charcoal, sand, pebbles, stone, maybe a vegetation layer. And then you pour water in it from the top with a very small little outflow at the bottom, just a little drip system. And slowly that water filters through each layer, going from very coarse grain all the way to very fine grain sediment. And it filters out all the impurities. Well, most of the impurities, you hope. And hopefully those smallest of bacteria are also filtered out, and it should be clean, fresh drinking water.
Even the smallest things we take for granted, I guess, in regular life,
that,
right?
That is
just
true.
Become major, major issues. I'm trying to picture, you know, landing out of the helicopter into a new environment, and you're making that first assessment, the first understanding of what your environment's going to be. What are you looking for at that moment? What's the first food source that you're trying to find to know that you're going to be able to get it through the next couple days?
Yeah, when I'm first dropped off, like you said, I'm observing everything about the environment, picking up the smells, the wind on my face, the heat of the sun, the topography, everything I'm noticing. But what I'm really focusing on is shelter building material and whether or not there may be a storm coming. Those are top priorities.
Before you're dropped off, do you get to look at the weather forecast, or are you just sitting there going, I don't know?
They unfortunately, I don't know, because they tell me what country I'm going to, but they don't tell me where in the country. And so, I mean, it's unbelievably difficult. For example, Madagascar, it has mountainous regions, coastal regions, desert regions. You have no idea what region they're going to put you in. All you know is the country that you're going to. And so you really don't know. It's a mystery.
What have been general things that you're most successful with when you're on the ground in these different environments? What are sort of your go-to for hunting or for foraging?
No, great question. There's a lot of survival skills that a lot of people practice and teach that I won't even waste my time with. Mm-hmm. And then there's others that I really, really focus on. A bow drill friction fire, that's my go-to friction fire method, usually regardless of the environment. But then there's other things like pitfall traps. I don't mess with those because they take so much energy to create.
Yeah.
For that, you know, 1 in a million lottery chance that you're going to get a big kill. So typically I try to weigh the percentages.
I've watched a few episodes. I know fishing is one of the main sources of protein that you can get at. I know eels are maybe a favorite. Tell us about eel hunting.
I love eels. They've got to be one of my favorite animals on the planet.
Why is that?
Well, surviving 40 days naked and afraid in Colombia, we were on an open savanna with patches of vegetation, and the film crew really hampered any hunting in that area, and it was very difficult. So I had to rely on the only creatures that were not disturbed, and those were the ones in the water. And so there were electric eels in Colombia, 5 to 6 feet long, weighing about 80 pounds, monsters. And I studied these things for weeks. I studied their behavior, how they ate, where they lived, their social structure. I learned everything about these creatures until I could kill them at will. Whenever I was hungry, whenever I wanted, I could go kill an electric eel. I knew when they would be out. I knew what they wanted for breakfast. And it was fabulous. And I took that knowledge with me to the Philippines. Of course, they don't have electric eels, but they do have river eels. And I was able to slaughter those things too. And it's funny how their behavior stays fairly similar on two different sides of the world. Because they live in similar areas and they have similar, features and physiology. And so it was fun for me to transport that knowledge from one side of the globe to the other.
So with the electric eels, they've got a mechanism, a defense and hunting mechanism. How did you overcome that?
Well, pain tolerance, I would say. There was only one electric eel that I killed that I was not shocked by. And I tell you what, I mean, I grew up on a farm. I know what an electric fence feels like.
Yeah, these guys are a little bit bigger.
They're much more powerful than a cattle fence. I couldn't believe it, especially when you're hitting and cutting through their spine with a metal knife. I mean, it sends that jolt directly to your heart. Mm-hmm. I have to say I was worried afterwards. After I got the shock multiple times, I was worried about my heart.
Yeah.
Electric eels do kill dozens of people every year on this planet. And I was killing some of the biggest ones that exist in South America. And so I was concerned, but I've got to say they're one of the most delicious meals I have ever had.
Much needed especially protein, I'm sure.
When you're naked and afraid, an electric eel does not stop you.
That's right.
Well, okay, so it's right there in the title, Naked and Afraid. And so tell us about the challenges of being naked in the environment. I can imagine, in terms of controlling your own temperature, of walking around barefoot all the time. Go ahead. What's the challenges? What's the reality?
Yeah. Most people, when they see the title on TV, they think the naked part is just for ratings.
Sure.
And while I thought that at the beginning also, that cannot be any farther from the truth. Being naked in these environments makes it exponentially more difficult than if I only had the clothes that I'm wearing now. And it's so, so difficult. I mean, for example, I got bit on the tip of the nether regions, which, men would not want to be bit on, by a venomous spider in Colombia.
Oh, geez.
And I swelled up as big as this guy's Pepsi Cola cup right here. I mean, it scared the wits out of me.
And I was just thinking about rain and hypothermia. That's what I was thinking.
Oh, man. I'll take hypothermia any day over for losing my manhood. And so there's very practical reasons why you would not want to be naked. And of course, then there's the survival ones. Yeah, absolutely. Hypothermia. You know, being covered by ants, biting ants in the middle of the night is horrendous.
Well, I could imagine just sleeping would just be a real challenge,
oh,
right?
Oh, my goodness.
You're on the floor.
Sleeping's so difficult. And also sunburn. I mean, a lot of us do not go to tanning beds weekly. You know, there's places on our body that don't see sun 365 days a year, and those places get sunburned horribly because you're out in the sun all day long. You cannot afford to stay in your shelter. You have to be out hunting and fishing and foraging. And so sunburn is a very real risk as well.
How about getting around? How the feet deal with all this?
It's one of the most difficult things of Naked and Afraid, honestly, is being without shoes. And I always get the question, why don't you guys make shoes? We make shoes, but it's boring, and so oftentimes it doesn't make the cut for television. Also, the shoes you make are made out of vegetation. So as the vegetation dries, it becomes brittle. Oftentimes it becomes sharp, and so it starts cutting your feet. It starts breaking, and you have to make shoes once again. And it's very labor-intensive. So for me, it's easier to fight off infection for the first 10 days or 2 weeks until my feet are tough enough to withstand those thorns themselves.
Mm-hmm. Jeez.
Okay, next question. What are the most interesting parasites you've contracted?
Oh, dear goodness. oh, dear goodness. Well, I've got an African tick bite fever in Botswana. That was actually for the series of Dual Survival that I filmed on Discovery Channel. That was miserable. And then I got bacterial meningitis in the Philippines. I was in a hospital in Dallas, Texas, in an infectious disease unit for all of last Christmas. I got Rocky Mountain spotted fever in, of all places, the Philippines. I didn't know that was possible. Evidently, they have a Filipino cousin that they have yet to name, so they still refer to it as Rocky Mountain spotted fever. But interestingly enough, one of the times I did not contract a disease was when I was in Botswana after I had already gotten tick bite fever. And I was dehydrated. We didn't have any water. We had been hiking for days. And we stumbled upon some wet elephant dung. And it was the only source of moisture we could find. We were on the verge of having to quit the challenge. And so we wring that dung out into our mouths and drank cups of moisture. I wouldn't call it water. I would call it moisture. But interestingly enough, I didn't catch anything from that. But I end up catching diseases from, of all things, walking through mud water or something. So.
I started my zoo career as an elephant keeper, and I would have no problem drinking elephant moisture. It's a quick digestion process, and basically just various stages of grass being digested.
So it tastes like tea is what you're saying.
Yes, absolutely.
It does not taste like tea. I can raise my hand.
If you only had a little bit of milk and sugar, it'd be perfect.
But no, you're right. It is probably one of the safest dungs you could drink if you were to drink dung.
Oh, that's interesting.
Next time.
Next time I run into that problem.
If you're dehydrated in Africa,
there's a serious side to this too, and having survivorship skills can have its, you know, benefits in our everyday life. You know, if we were to get stranded, I mean, there are some possible situations where that can happen. Mm. Can you tell us a little bit about examples where this does come up?
No, absolutely. I mean, I receive thousands of messages a week from all over the world, people grateful for the skills we teach. But one of the most impactful was a story that I received of a 9-year-old girl who was in a plane crash with her grandparents in Oregon, in the dense forests of Oregon. And the plane went down and her grandparents were killed. But she survived, covered in blood and injuries, but she survived. They couldn't find the plane. And this girl spent 6 days in the wild by herself with absolutely nothing except the clothes on her back. And she ended up surviving. And she found the rescue teams that were looking for her miles and miles away from the crash site. And they asked her, they said, "How in the world did you know how to do these things?" And she said, "Because I watched Jeff and EJ on Dual Survival every Wednesday night with my grandparents." And so, I mean, that it makes the hair stand up on my arms just talking about it, because it, you know, I'm having fun out there. I'm enjoying myself. I'm doing it for a career. But the skills are very, very important. We never know when we're going to find ourselves in a situation like that. This girl, she just got on an airplane. Her grandfather was a pilot. She had done this hundreds of times. She never expected to be in this situation. And the truth is, we don't expect that either. But it could happen, and it could happen tomorrow.
Right. What are some of the most basic skills that are essential? Everybody should know how to do what?
I think the two most essential skills are shelter building and being able to purify or filter water. If you can obtain shelter and if you can obtain fresh drinking water, you can survive weeks in any environment. And that should give you enough time to be rescued if you were in a situation like that.
We have a very important question to ask you, and that has to do with a couple of the hazards that you might find around these parts in Idaho. So we have a couple venomous snakes in Idaho. Can you help us out? What are they?
I believe they are the western diamondback rattlesnake and the prairie rattlesnake.
Have you come across these animals before?
I have gotten bit by a diamondback rattlesnake.
Oh, do tell.
I was rafting by myself, solo, in the Frank Church wilderness of salmon. Uh-huh. And I was passing through some thick brush next to the bank, and a snake fell in my raft.
Oh, great.
And I thought it was a rattlesnake. I was not sure. I now think that it probably wasn't. Anyway, I leaped out of the raft, dragged my raft ashore, being like, thank God, you know, that thing could have got me. I got bit on the ankle while standing on shore by another rattlesnake. it was crazy. Long story short, I ran 2 miles back to the ranger station, called for an ambulance. I thought I was in deep doo-doo. Turns out the venom was not injected bite, which occurs on a certain percentage of bites. And so
that's right.
I was very lucky, very lucky.
Awesome. And by the way, if anyone's interested in working with Jeff on some of these survival shows, spend the time to learn the difference between venomous and poisonous. That will determine whether you get on or not on his shows.
Absolutely.
What's the difference?
So venom has to be injected. Poison has to be ingested.
Right.
So you eaten or drank. Yeah. Yeah. And so snakes, spiders, bees, wasps, they're venomous. They inject. So, all right. And we want to thank Jeff for joining us today. Great talk. And to learn more about what Jeff is up to, please visit his website, jeffzauschtv.com. That is Jeff, ZAUSCHTV.com.
Thank you, guys. It's been a pleasure. Mm-hmm.
Shows are recorded here at the studios of KISU Pocatello. Visit us at KISU.org for questions, comments, and audio for all our programs. Our theme music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock, and please remember to get outside and enjoy the nature of Idaho.